Welcome to the film experience. I'm your host, Nathaniel R., and I'm here with Murtada Elfalbel.
Hello, Nathaniel.
So we saw a movie together this week.
We did, yes.
The Hate U Give. Now, did you know, I'm not a, you know, big Tupac person. Like, I had no idea that it was from a song.
I mean, I know that song, but I didn't actually make the connection until I was in the movie.
Yeah. Well, they don't let you miss the connection in the movie. They spell it out for you.
Several times, which is good.
So the movie was good. I think we both liked it.
Yes.
With some reservations, possibly.
Yes, I think my experience of the movie was like, as I'm sitting there watching it, I was like really into it and just taken with the story and the performances, and I even clapped a few times, you know, without noise, obviously, so not to disturb people, and snapped my fingers. But as the movie ended, then you start, you know, and you start thinking about it a little bit, you just find so many holes in it and things that, oh, wow, that happened. Oh, maybe I didn't like that part. So the experience of during and after was a little different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that comes with probably the intended audience. Not to diss teenagers, but it's definitely a young adult movie. Like, based on something for young adults, pitched toward young adults. So it's kind of a YA social issues movie. And those movies tend to be very, you know, color inside the lines, like make everything very clear to people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does that. And which maybe, you know, I think teenagers, especially teenagers today, with social media and all of that, are just so in on everything. They're smarter than most of us, or maybe all of us, so I don't know why the movie doesn't trust them.
Hmm. But are they smarter than us? No, I'm just kidding. No, you know, there's been people wondering why there isn't more, given that we're such a visual society, why there isn't more visual sophistication in terms of people understanding, like, storytelling just through imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, still, like, and this has been the case since, you know, cinema had sound, still filmmakers do lots of narration and lots of things to make sure you're following.
Yeah.
But technically, we should all be more advanced as a society to not necessarily need that. So.
Yeah. So do you want to tell people what The Hate U Give is about, just briefly, in case people haven't seen it?
You're wanting us to be more professional and not just gab.
Or we don't have to do that.
We should have probably done that at the outset. So for those who had not seen The Hate U Give, it's based on a young adult novel, I believe, of the same title.
Yes, it's the same title.
About a girl who witnesses a police shooting. And so she has to come to grips with whether or not she's going to use her voice in such a public way to speak out and be an activist, rather than just keep her head down, which is the way she's been operating her whole life. Because she goes to a private school and, you know, she's thinking of college and all that. So she's just trying to be, I guess it plays into respectability politics a little bit, is mm-hmm. one of the subtextual themes, because she's always talking about the versions of herself that she presents to people.
Yes, and that's how the movie sort of starts, presenting the two versions of her, the one at home and in her community, and the other one in her private school, that is mostly white.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, I'm not sure this is intentional or just self-delusion, but I didn't actually think the versions of her were very different.
I mean, you know, she put the hood on and took it off, the hoodie on and took it off.
Yeah, so as but what I'm saying is there's extremely facile differences that she seems to think are profound differences. Because she doesn't actually act like a different person when she's in her black neighborhood versus when she's in the white school.
I mean, the voiceover wants us to believe that, because she instead of them showing us how she behaves differently, she just keeps telling us that she doesn't say this, she doesn't do that, you know, like, instead of, like you said, visual, it's not very visual, so they're just telling us through voiceover, and the film is sort of really reliant on the voiceover in explaining everything.
Right, but I guess I'm thinking specifically of, like, when she goes to, like, when the main plot kicks in, she goes to a party in her neighborhood, which is where she meets an old friend and where things really start to get serious in the movie. But her behavior at that party, I really liked, I should preface this by saying I really liked Amanda Stenberg's performance. I thought she was very good. So me saying that there's not these two different versions of her, she keeps saying is not about the performance itself. It's more about the script. But what I'm saying is she presents herself in she's very reserved even within her own community.
Yeah, and maybe that's sort of part of her arc, part of the arc of the character, because she is very reserved in both communities, right? Yeah. Like, she's always thinking before acting, whether at school or whether back with her friends from her community. And then, like, as the story sort of goes and she finds her, like that's her narrative. It's, like, about how to find her voice.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I agree. She doesn't, you know, she always stands out. I mean, when she is at school, she stands out by just being one of the very few non-white students there. And then, you know, when she's in that party in her neighborhood, everybody's talking about how she is dressed and dressed differently than all of the other girls there. And it, like, it becomes a thing.
Yeah.
So she's always an outsider wherever she goes. So I agree with you. It's that she's the one who stands out, or the film definitely wants us to see her as this different other.
Right. Yeah, so, I don't know where I'm going with that other than to say that was something that bothered me a little bit about the movie that didn't need to bother me, because I think people don't always perceive themselves accurately, so I think that's something interesting that could have been more interesting, but I actually think the movie believes that she's two completely different people, which she's not, is my point.
Yeah. The movie definitely believes she is. What I liked about the movie is that it's the story of it is like it's a gut punch, and it's a story that you can't help but be moved. You know,
yes.
They present, you know, social injustice, and the whole way they build up that scene where this friend where her friend gets killed while she's in the car with him. That was a very good scene in that they build the tension, and you get to. He's only introduced in that scene and the scene before it, but you get like a lifetime of their relationship, the way they talk. And so when he goes, when he's killed, you really feel the loss. So I think that was sort of the best part of the film for me in building that character, because the whole narrative depends on him getting killed and us getting invested in that injustice and in that murder. And so I really loved how the film built that character and the performance of Algie Smith as Khalil, her friend. I think that was the strongest part of the film.
And as we said, exiting the screening, poor Algie Smith keeps being brutalized on screen.
By white policemen.
Yeah. Because he also was the star of Detroit, for any of you who saw that. Anyway. So, yeah, but there were...
Now the police are coming for us right now. I guess they heard us.
It's my windows are not properly sound insulated, which is kind of a problem since I live right facing the street.
Yeah, so you were saying about Algie Smith, yeah, he was also brutalized in Detroit last year.
He's a good actor, I like him.
He's very good, and he's very charismatic, and, you know, he didn't have a lot of scenes, but it was a great performance.
Yeah, and you totally, yeah, that, I don't have any issues with the, I feel like I'm nitpicking, so I just want to say I don't have any issues with the actors. I think it was a very well-acted movie. I was very impressed with everyone, you know, from, especially, like, the parents. I always love Regina Hall, but I'm not as familiar with Russell Hornsby, who was very strong as the dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen him. He was in Fences last year, I think, or was that 2 years ago?
Right. He was, yeah.
Yeah. But that felt like a, you know, a very well-lived-in relationship between the parents, and both actors were really good. Mm-hmm. All the relationships, like, you know, there is the relationships between the two parents, that was very well done. And then there is his ex, sort of the dad's ex, I don't know what it is, somebody he had a child with. So was another sort of relationship that was sort of funny, that actress who played that character was sort of funny. And then the relationships that Star had at school with her friend, that was also explored really well. And it's sort of all of these stories fit the main narrative, but also there are smaller narratives built within the characters that also have arcs. So they start somewhere and they go somewhere, not always resolved neatly and tidily, but I thought it was all acted well.
I mean, technically, it's a pretty, other than that it was hand-holding you way too much, I felt. Other than that, I think the screenplay's good in terms of it's structured really well. It gives you a lot of information about a lot of different characters. So it feels like one of those adaptations that's really carefully thought through how to present the entire book to you.
Yes.
Rather than just sort of haphazard. You know, it feels like it's, I haven't read the book, but it comes across like you're getting everything that the book probably gave you, because books, you know, tend to have so much more detail.
Yeah.
So I liked all the characters. I just didn't like how it kept leading me. So that was kind of like a nitpicky thing.
I mean, one of the things we talked about after we left, and we're not going to give that because it's a spoiler, but there is sort of something that's introduced, and you know how we talked about, like, you know what's going to happen, because it's like Chekhov's gun. There is like maybe 5 Chekhov guns in the hate you give. It's not just one.
Right. Yeah. So it is kind of predictable, but the character, you know, one mark of good movies and movies that go over really well and play well with people is when you just really love every character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because even the characters that you're not meant to love, like, I was involved in them.
They're all well drawn, yes.
Yeah, like the Anthony Mackie who I was complaining afterwards, like, this role feels a little beneath him at this point in his career. because it seems like something he would have played, like, you know, 15 years ago when he was less famous, because it's kind of a one-note character, but then, like, the star's best friend, in quotes, who ends up having issues in their friendship, you know, you're not meant to really like her, but even that storyline was evolving.
Yes.
So.
And it had my favorite line of the movie. Why did you unfollow me on Tumblr?
Oh my god. I totally forgot about that line until just this moment, and now I just feel blissful.
Tumblr is taken very seriously in this movie, and I love it. I love the movie for it.
So Amanda Stenberg, she's really good.
Yes, she can carry a movie. Like, it's a great performance.
I'm kind of relieved for her because I actually did mean to see that earlier movie she made, When Hands Touch, I think. Just because I was curious because of the director, but, Ama Asante. But I didn't see that one, but I did see The Darkest Mind, the sci-fi-ish supernatural kids with powers movies that she also was the lead of this year. And it was terrible. And she was terrible in it. But everybody was terrible in it. So I was a little worried since I wasn't super familiar with her, but she's great in this movie.
Absolutely. The lead performance is everything. I just would say, you know, let's not digress, but one thing about Ama Asante, how many interracial relationship movies can one director make?
We're going to find out with her career, because it's still pretty new career.
Yes. I mean, you know, you could say Scorsese does a lot of, like, you know, Italian mob movies, so maybe. We'll see.
Everybody's got their thing. You know, Sofia Coppola makes movies about sort of poor, rich white girls, so.
Yes, that's true.
It's okay to have your own thing.
Yeah.
Although,
you do have to
stretch once in a while.
Yes. I've seen online people talk about Russell Hornsby, our sort of like in the awards conversation on Twitter, and I've seen it several people mention that. I don't know how you feel about that. Like, to me, it wasn't the performance that stood out. He is very good. And I don't know if people are saying that because they think that that category is the one that's most open, but I think it's Stenberg who is the sort of most powerful performance in the movie.
Oh yeah, Stenberg's definitely the MVP of the movie, but and she has a lot to carry. There's a lot she's having to do.
And she even almost every scene. Like, I don't remember like a scene that she's not in.
Yeah, no, it's a total 100% leading role. yeah, she's very good in it. Like, I think it's because he's so sympathetic and he gives the movie sort of its initial gravitas,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think people are gravitating to him. Because if he was a famous actor,
uh-huh.
this would totally be like an Oscar. It would be a done deal that he was going to get campaigned and all that.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a big enough role and it has enough meaty scenes that it wouldn't be shocking to see him nominated, other than that it's always competitive, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he does, like, he is sort of given, there is a couple of the scenes that we talked about how the movie telegraphs a lot. And he has two scenes where he basically needs to explain things, mm-hmm. but he does it, I thought he does it so well, and that a lesser actor in not giving such a great, like a lesser performance would have been stuck in those scenes. But he mm-hmm. delivers those speeches so well, and even though, like, while you're watching it, you're just caught up in what he's saying, and only later do you think, like, did we really need him to tell us all of that? So, and maybe that's why his performance pops.
Yeah. I was actually thinking, while watching him, I was thinking of Octavia Spencer in Fruitvale.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because, not to compare the performances themselves, because I think he's a lot better in this than she was in Fruitvale, even though she got, you know, some buzz. But she has that scene in Fruitvale, which one of the movies, like, Fruitvale's really good, but it has a few, like, really, really heavy-handed, clunky moments. And one of them is that telegraphing thing you're talking about, where she has to get serious and be like, you know, why don't you take the train tonight?
Yeah.
And it's mm-hmm. all, it's so heavy-handed and telegraphing, and I felt watching it that she did, I mean, she's such a good actor, but I felt like it was like an impossible scene. Like, and I think she was directed to push that line of dialogue mm-hmm. beyond how anybody in real life would deliver it. You know, like, mm-hmm. why don't you take the train so you can drink or whatever? You know, it becomes this very sort of prophecy as opposed to just a casual conversation. So he has a lot of scenes like that, as you're saying, but he is able to elevate them rather than get bogged down in them.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when I was watching them, I never even noticed that these scenes don't ring true, or that, you know, like you said, a character wouldn't speak that way. Oh, they in real life, they wouldn't speak that way. They would only speak that way to tell the audience what's going to happen. It's right. Only later, after the movie ended, that I was like, oh. So So yeah, I think he did a great job.
Yeah. And then I know we have to share with everyone your reaction to KJ Apa's performance, who plays Star's white boyfriend.
His whole performance is just saying Star! Star! He just, that's his whole thing. He is so amazed by her. He's so flabbergasted. He's always surprised. He is just there.
He comes across as a little dim. Because he's continually confused and like, Star, Star, you're right.
Yeah, he can't believe what she's doing, no matter what she's doing.
Yeah, after you said that to me after the screening, I was kind of like, oh my god, how does that role read on paper? Like, was he like, wow, I'm going to say this name over and over again?
Yeah, I think 80% of his dialogue is Star.
Yeah, so he's very enamored with his girlfriend. But I will say, I was really worried for that character, given how heavy-handed the movie was. But the movie's actually very sweet about their relationship.
It's very, very sweet. And yes, and you think, you know, there are ways where you're like, oh, where is this going? But it's all so sweet. Like, they're both really in love and really supportive of each other, despite all the stuff that's happening around them that, you know, it's just, it works so well.
Yeah. So, two thumbs up for the hate you give.
If I want to say one thing, if we thought Russell Hornsby was saddled with a couple of speeches, I think the worst speech was given to poor Common. Because basically Common gets the speech of, like, basically not all cops.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that was excruciating. Like, do we need this in this movie about systematic injustice? Do we need a man, and a black man at that, to give us a whole speech about not all cops are bad?
Well, I mean, there are black cops. So surely that's a perspective, or that's a thing black cops have had to deal with. This idea that they're terrible.
Yes, I guess, but that scene really took me out of the whole movie.
Uh-huh.
Because the whole thing is about, it's building this story about this thing that happened to this young black man, which is something that is happening in real life almost daily, and we know it. And we know that, and we also know that, you know, not 100% of cops are terrible people. So we know that. So I don't think the movie needed that. And to me, this felt like this is a studio film. And maybe this was like, I don't know if it's in, you know, if you read the book, listeners, tell us if this scene is in the book or not. But to me, this is a studio movie. And I felt that if this was an independent production, they wouldn't have had that scene. This felt to me like studio meddling, saying, oh, you know, we need to make sure it's not all cops.
But I mean, you could read that for just about everything in the movie. The movie really is trying to cover all its bases.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, like, in Star's friends in the white school, you know, even those characters are set up so you get not all white people, you know? Because one of her friends turns out to be kind of racist, but then some of her other friends are so supportive of her. You know what I'm saying? So you're getting...
I guess.
Feel like the movie was trying to play to everyone's concerns about the issue.
Mm-hmm. But those other scenes didn't bother me, I guess. This is the one that really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if there is one thing I would, like, clock this movie for, it's that scene. And it's such an impossible thing to play, too, and poor Common doesn't fare so well.
Well, but don't you think that's kind of rescued by her reaction to...
I mean, her reaction is the only reaction you can have to that bullshit speech. obviously, yes, her reaction is great, but... anyway, that's my, like... That's the only time I was out of this movie, and I was just like, I can't believe you're doing this.
Mm-hmm. I was a little out of it toward the end, because it really... Oh, it's longer than it needs to be as a movie, and it has a whole, like, oh wait, this isn't the climax, this is the climax, no wait, this is the climax. It like, it's mm-hmm. it layers it on really thick in the last like 15 minutes.
Yeah. I don't know what is it with this year. It was so funny because I was looking at my letterbox earlier with like the length of movies that I saw this year, and there are a lot of movies that do not need in 2018 to be this long. Like Red Sparrow was almost 2.5 hours. I'm like, why?
Which one?
So Red Sparrow. Have you seen that?
Oh, I have not. No.
So there were a couple of movies there. I was looking at the longest movies, and I was like, why are they so long? They do not need. And I hear you about this. It could have been 10 minutes shorter.
Well, and I mean, I. Like, it's probably a reach to say that it's all Netflix's fault, but I do feel like streaming television has sort of made storytellers feel like anything's fine. Put as much as you want into anything. Like, you don't need to streamline, you don't need to, you know, because there's just so much filler in everything. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes you'll be watching, like, a streaming series, and, like, one thing will happen in an entire episode. And you're like, really? An hour? Just for one thing to happen. So I do think it's a problem right now because of this training of audiences to just sit there. It's like a really passive thing that's happening. No, you will sit there for however long we want you to.
Yeah, we have no choice.
So.
So I think we recommend this movie, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we both had some reservations, but it's totally a good sit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go see it. Go see the Sternberg performance. There'll be a big star soon, I think.
Star will be a star.
Star will be a star, yes.
We probably should have said at the beginning, with how many times we've said star, that her name in the movie is Star.
The other movies that we've also, that opened this week are Burning and Border, and I think you've seen Suspiria and I haven't seen it.
Right. So, our next two movies, as I said, and I wrote brief capsule reviews, like, a few weeks ago on these movies, but you might want to not listen to this part if you haven't seen them, because they're both very, very hard movies to discuss without spoilers. But they're both very exciting for the fact that you don't know where they're going.
Yes.
So it's better to not know too much. So I would normally not tell you, don't listen to this since we are recording it for you, but if you haven't seen these movies, you might want to not listen to the rest of this. So, Border and Burning. Which one do you want to start with, Murtada?
So let's start with Burning, because I had the opposite reaction of with Burning that I did to The Hate U Give. While I was watching Burning, and it is an even longer sit, it's 2.5 hours, I was, all the time, I'm like, where the fuck is this movie going? What the fuck is this movie even? So I wasn't with it. But the minute it ended, and especially the next day when I woke up, I was like, this was fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
So it's so different in that I wasn't maybe as enjoying it. I was enjoying it because it's beautiful to look at, but I was also just a little not content with what I'm seeing, because I didn't sort of get it. I was like, what is happening? But the more I thought about it, the better it becomes. And now I can't actually wait to see it again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, it feels meandering, but then afterwards it feels very purposeful.
Yes, it's a very sort of like contained, it's only mostly three characters. It's one guy who is a drifter. It takes place in Seoul, or maybe a little bit outside of Seoul, because there are, some of the scenes are near the border.
Yeah, Korea. He doesn't live in the city,
mm-hmm.
So he's kind of like a poor guy who's kind of like a farming community or something he lives on.
Yes.
So he meets this girl who also grew up in his hometown, but who he hasn't seen in years. And so how the movie starts is they're new relationship. They haven't seen each other for years. And she's very aggressive with him and sleeps with him right away. And so he becomes kind of obsessive about her. Mm-hmm. And then she leaves on vacation. This is all in the first half hour. And then it just like, where is this going? She leaves on vacation. And when she returns with a guy who is, he compares to Jay Gatsby from The Great Gatsby because he's so rich and mysterious and anyway, and then the three of them have this triangular relationship that the whole time you're like, what is happening?
Yep. And that guy is played by Steven Yeun, who is fucking fantastic in this performance.
Amazing. He's amazing. Yeah. And it would never happen in a million years, but I would love it if he was nominated for supporting actor.
Yeah. I mean, he is sort of, you know, hitting the promo trail because obviously he's like the star in America, and he's like doing all kinds of interviews and appearances. So he's at least getting people to talk about the movie.
Yeah.
It's such a great performance, and the the relationship between the three, like there's jealousy and intrigue, and they kind of like all, and you never sort of get what any of them is feeling towards the other at any point. Mm-hmm. And also like in Silo, the three of them are also really interesting characters, and yeah. They all sort of like get scenes where you really sort of dive into their psyche and what they're doing. It's just the more, you know, it's just a movie that you remember whole scenes and you're just like thinking about it even more. Mm-hmm. And I can't even tell you right now what's it about, but I know that I love it.
So now I'm like, maybe we shouldn't have said, don't listen if you don't want spoilers, but I will say, okay, so this part's the spoilery part. There's a scene, I think it's about halfway through the movie, but I could be wrong. It could be further into the movie, that I view as kind of the movie's pivot scene. And it's also my favorite scene in the movie because I think every single thing that the movie's doing all sort of collides in this one scene. And then the movie's not the same afterwards at all. So it's a scene where the girl he wants to be his girlfriend, who has returned with this sexy guy played by Steven Yeun. They show up at his apartment or at his home in this tiny farming community unannounced. And so they just hang out there for the day. And I think, are they getting stoned? I'm trying to remember what happens.
Yes, they are getting stoned.
Yeah, so they're getting stoned. And then he ends up having this very strange conversation with his rival, the sexy rich guy.
Mm-hmm. His name is Ben.
Whose name is Ben. They have a very strange conversation that sort of makes him even more obsessive, the lead character, only in a different direction. So before he was very obsessed with the girl, but now he becomes very obsessed with the guy, not in a sexual way, but like, what's his deal?
Yeah, well, he's so fascinating. I want to know more.
Right. And while that's happening, the girl is off in her own sort of stoned reverie, and you get the sense that both men are sort of done with her in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strange scene, and it's very long and mm-hmm. very fascinating. And then afterwards, the movie gets more violent, that's all I want to say, and more upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can read the movie as what is discovered is not actually what's happening, but you can also read the movie as a traditional thriller where the lead character has discovered the truth and so becomes more... I'm still acting like we're not doing spoilers.
Yeah. You can just spoil it. I think that scene also turns around, like, what I liked about what you said is that you said they both sort of are not into her anymore, but they're not into her anymore because she's bearing her soul in that scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, she is really telling them and us a lot of what she's feeling. And that is such a turn off for them. That's when you like, when you're seeing somebody as they really are for the first time and they're telling you who they are, that's what makes the scene so strong.
Yeah. And because they've both, in very, very different ways, they've both objectified her. So this is a thing that, you know, people a lot of times talk about the male gaze in movies, and, you know, nudity becomes an issue with that. But I actually, she takes her clothes off in this scene, and she's stoned and dancing. And I think it's one of those uses of nudity that I think is completely brilliant, because the reaction to it, she's a very beautiful woman, but the reaction to it is just so toxically masculine.
It is, yep.
And so it becomes this, like, the thing I love about the movie is that no matter which direction you look at it from, you're seeing something possibly different.
Yeah, which is why it bears sort of watching it more than once.
Yeah.
And, you know, to sort of finish talking about that scene, I mean, it's the cliche of, like, she's not bearing her body, she's bearing her soul, which in most movies is actually a cliche, but in this movie, it's the reality.
Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, it's also a very depressing scene because you realize that neither guy loves her, and they've just, they're both only using her insofar as what it makes them feel about their own life type of thing.
Yes.
Like, they're not interested in her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she's not, I don't want to make it sound like she doesn't, a character that's also a cipher and she's only a catalyst for what happens with these two guys, because she's also aware of what's happening in an interesting way, I think. Because she doesn't really forgive what the reaction of that scene.
Yeah, it's yeah. I mean, I liked her character a lot, and I know there's been some critics who have taken the movie to issue because it's another movie where, you know, violence happens to women, or women are violated, but I didn't really have that problem with it. But then again, I'm a man, so what do I know? Mm-hmm.
Well, we should state here that we're talking about the fact that the movie becomes violent and upsetting, but you don't actually, in no way is that gratuitous, because you don't actually see the violence.
You do not, yeah. It's not shown.
It's implied heavily, which is one of the reasons why I think the movie is very confusing to watch at first, because so many of the plot details are all inferred rather than shown or spoken.
Yeah, I mean, this is another thing of, like, this movie doesn't tell you anything.
Right.
Nothing.
It doesn't even tell you whether or not she has a cat, and she talks about the cat a lot. And
yes,
you go and into her apartment, but you never see the cat.
Yeah, it doesn't, it's not interested in telegraphing anything. In fact, it's the opposite. And the dialogue is very spare. Like, it doesn't even have a lot of dialogue. So it's just, it's such a mood piece. You just want to, like, it's a movie that you sort of, I think the second time I see it, I'll lose myself in it a lot more, because I was trying to figure out the plot.
Yeah.
So if you're listening and you haven't seen this movie, just my advice to you, don't try and figure out the plot, because at the end it doesn't matter, really. Just let it just go into it, let it envelop you.
Yeah. Although, as I said earlier, it does, if you want to view it as a thriller, you can form a plot in your head that is very traditional thriller about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there is a part of it that it's a whodunit, right?
Yeah. So all of that was very vague, and so we didn't get spoilery.
No, we did describe that scene in pretty in a lot of detail, that one scene.
Yeah.
That's the amazing scene. But so this is South Korea's submission to the Oscars, and South Korea, I can't even believe I'm saying this, has never been nominated for the foreign language Oscar.
It is so absurd. It is so absurd. South Korean cinema is one of the most exciting cinemas in the world. And It's absurd. I can't even.
Yeah. It's so many great movies, especially in the last decade or so.
Yeah.
So.
And this is from Lee Chang-dong, who did Secret Sunshine. And what am I forgetting? Oasis?
Poetry.
Oh, and Poetry, which was my favorite movie by him.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the sort of bigger profile of this movie with Steven Yeun in it and the way that it's getting, you know, a good release, I'm not saying it's a big release right now, but it's getting a good release in the U.S. and released early in the year, mm-hmm. will that help it in that, in the foreign language category?
The Oscars have been under a lot of fire after Oscar So White about, you know, sort of racial hang-ups and their demographic or whatever. Forget it with Asian movies. They never get nominated for awards. The actors never get nominated. Like, South Korea's never been nominated for an Oscar. Thailand's never been nominated for an Oscar. Like, there's so many countries in Asia that never get nominated, despite having these, like, amazing movies. So, I really... Like, China's been nominated twice, I think? Only twice. And there's so many amazing Chinese movies. So... Because the Oscars clearly have a bias against Asian cinema. So that's a problem. Like, maybe somebody on that Foreign Film Executive Committee should be someone who's interested in Asian movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because, I wouldn't necessarily think it was a problem if, like, South Korea just had this weird Oscar record, right? But the fact is there are tons of Asian countries where that's true of.
Mm-hmm.
That have famous cinema, and Oscar just doesn't care.
Yeah,
and it makes me crazy.
I mean, the Oscar foreign is based, the foreign language category is very biased towards Western Europe, European cinema in general. Like, it's just like that's what they mostly nominate. But yes, they are, like, I can't believe South Korea has never been nominated. Like, that is just crazy, crazy that they haven't been. So there is bias against Asian cinema, but I think it's more just their bias for European cinema. It's what they see and what they can relate to the most.
But yeah. But I'm just saying, it's my pet peeve is the lack of Asian representation at the Oscars.
Yeah, but to bring it back to Burning, this is a great movie and a movie that has a higher profile than usual because there is an American star in it.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that helps it. Even if it doesn't help it to actually land a nomination, it hopefully helps it remain in the conversation until they announce that shortlist so that more people can see it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it really deserves to be seen.
Totally. Unfortunately, it is a very competitive year. I mean, I should say fortunately. It's nice that we have so many movies that are getting people excited in this category. So, I mean, it's going to be hard for anybody beyond Roma to get nominated this year because there's so many of them that are getting great reviews.
It's so great. Like Shoplifters is amazing and Burning and Border, which we're going to talk about, and The Guilty from Denmark. There's just so many good movies.
Yeah. I thought Capernaum was really good from Lebanon. I know it's very divisive, but I thought it was very good. And I haven't seen I Am Not a Witch from the UK, but I keep hearing that's good, too.
It's fantastic.
Oh, you have seen that?
I've seen it. It was playing last month, right? I think it's no longer in theaters, but hopefully it will be, on home video or streaming soon.
Yeah, and the Argentinian submission opens next week, I believe, as well. And that's also good. And queer. Those of you who are interested.
Yeah, surprisingly, we were just talking about European cinema, and surprisingly, I haven't, when France announced I don't even know the name now. I know I read it somewhere, but it's such a low-profile movie choice for France.
I know. It's like, France has been, like we were just talking about, France always gets nominated, but actually they've had a really tough time for the past, like, 10 years or so. Like, somehow BPM got shunned.
L wasn't nominated.
Yeah, I mean, craziness. Yeah. And the only French nominee recently has been in Turkish, so what are you going to do? Maybe they're tired of France for the moment. Which is fine. France has 37 nominations. It's fine.
That's a lot, yeah. I mean, another country that has huge cinema industry that's never been nominated is Egypt, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the Academy has a lot of blind spots, but with the renaissance of Asian cinema and sort of its popularity in art houses all over the world in the last 2 decades or so, it is ridiculous that, you know, something, you know, a whole country like South Korea hasn't never been nominated. Yeah. That's so ridiculous.
For those who are curious, the countries who've submitted the most, the five countries who have been the most shunned over and over and over again with Oscar, number one is Portugal, oddly enough. Number two, Romania. Number three, Egypt. And tied for fourth with most submissions without being nominated other than those three countries are the Philippines and South Korea.
Yep. Yeah.
So anyway.
So what about Sweden? Let's talk about Border. I think Sweden is a foreign language sort of mainstay, right? Because of Bergman mostly.
Yeah, Sweden, yeah, they've done well over the years for themselves. Not as well as Denmark recently with Oscar, but Denmark is super popular with Oscar right now. So Sweden has had 14 nominations over the years. I do think Border could be a surprise because it's very memorable. Like, it's impossible to not remember that you've seen it, unlike some movies.
Yes. And it's also, it's a very good movie.
Yeah. But it's also just so weird. It's like, okay, we're going there.
It's very, very weird.
I mean, from the very first shot, which I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, is just a super, super macro close-up on the lead characters, like, mouth and nose.
Maybe, I don't remember, but
anyway, it's one of the very first shots, and she's just sort of sniffing, and it's
yes.
extremely aggressive close-up of this sort of unfortunate-looking person sniffing, and it immediately puts you in, like, what am I watching?
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of sniffing in the movie. It's just... You can call it Border, a sniffing story.
Yeah, so basically it's the story of a border guard, a customs officer, who has a sort of unique sense of smell in that she claims she can smell fear and other emotions. So she basically chose the perfect line of work as a customs officer so she can find anything if someone's trying to smuggle anything. But she looks really weird and unattractive. There's a lot of, like, prosthetic makeup in the movie, which is extremely good prosthetic makeup. So I'm hoping they get some Oscar play in that category. Mm-hmm. And one day she meets a man who's coming through the customs line who she can't get any sense of his emotions.
Except he looks a little bit like her.
He looks a little bit like her, but... You know, she's sniffing, she can't figure anything out, and she's sure that it's suspect because she can't get a read at all. And so her reaction to him and the other customs officers reveals about him, which we will save for you because it's a very good twist in the movie.
So good.
Yeah, so that all sets in motion this chain of events where she's sort of on this journey to discover more about him and about herself. And but the interesting thing about it is that in addition to being completely weird with a completely memorable lead character and a plot you would never imagine about somebody who could smell things...
Yeah.
Is that in many ways it's completely like a procedural, like standard, like detective procedural.
Uh-huh. It's a thriller. Like they are trying to find out something. There is, again, a whodunit kind of.
Yeah. And so, but even in a more definitely in a more straightforward way than South Korea is burning.
Oh, yeah. It's like this movie, like, yeah, it's not burning. It tells you a lot.
Yeah. So even though the lead character is very unusual and the circumstances of the plot are very unusual, the actual structure of it is 100% like mystery thriller procedural. So in that way, I think it's going to be very accessible, unless they're just turned off by how just strange the main characters are.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite thing, what I loved most about this movie is that, to your point, it's thriller, but it also sort of flirts with magical realism, and there's this strange character at the center of it all who looks so strange and different and under this makeup, but the film is grounded in the emotional truths of this woman. Yeah. So, like, everything that happens, she reacts to it the way any other character in a movie would react. It's just not any other character, but what I'm trying to say is that she is emotionally available, and that's and we see the story from her perspective. And she reacts to everything in this way that, as a viewer, you get... you get connected to her and you get invested in her story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I definitely think that's a threat for the finalist list.
Yeah. It's also just like, it's unlike anything we will see at the movies this year. So I just loved it for that. It's so inventive. Like, it's also, you know, I think it's rooted in some sort of Scandinavian fairy tale stories.
Mythology,
like, I think,
yeah,
mythology. There's that part of it. And there is sort of the magical realism, and then there is the thriller, but it all just works, and it's so different than anything else, and it's such a good time at the movies.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Go see that one. I don't think you'll regret it if you see it.
No.
You might not love it, but you won't regret seeing it because it is not like anything you saw this year.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people will love it. I would say Border is lit. Is that because I just felt this movie was, you know, it's like a movie. It's like it's not real, but it's also real, so it makes it just such a movie. It's something you can only see in the movie, because it's not, even if you read it as a story,
right,
it's not going to work as well as you actually watch these characters with the makeup and the things that happen to them.
Yeah. And I will say it probably has the year's most memorable sex scene.
Oh, yes, for sure. So that alone is worth the price of admission. Cool. So
basically, we have three movies you have to go see. So we hope you saved your pennies for the fall, because this is when all the movies come out.
Yeah. Yes. I know. It's like every week now there is something new and different and something exciting at this theaters.
Do you want to ask anything about Suspiria? Are you going to Suspiria, Murtada?
Or
are you
avoiding
it?
I'm trying to avoid it, frankly. But I guess eventually I'll see it. But I can't promise when. You know what I'm scared about? I'm just really scared about the 2.5 hours. It's just like, because I just saw the 1977 Dario Argento one, and that was 90 minutes, and it felt so long, and I'm just like, I can't believe this is an hour longer than that, and I have to sit through it.
It's, yeah, I feel like I've already said this somehow, maybe in brief in an article, but the thing that's most surprising about it, maybe, is that it feels less like a remake than it's possible to be of something. Like,
so it's a completely different movie. It has no, like, apart from just the setup, it has no connection to the Argento.
Yeah, the setup is very, very similar. There's a dance school, there's witches, you know, because for those of you who haven't seen the Dario Argento classic, it's about a dance, a ballet, or not ballet, but... Or is it ballet? I don't remember. Anyway, it's a dance school run by a coven of witches. And it's very gruesome and scary and weird and super colorful. Definitely worth seeing, the original. The new one is a lot more intellectual, shall we say. Like, I felt like I needed cliff notes on sort of German history, and I felt, it was the time I was reminded that I never saw that German movie, The Bader-Meinhof Complex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From some years ago, because they reference, like, the Bader-Meinhof stuff constantly in Suspiria.
So it's still set in 1977, because that's when that happened.
It's set in the exact same year, same city, all of that, but it's so different, like, from the way it looks to, you know, the horror elements. It's just, it's extremely different movie. Like, there's no, like, let's remake this set piece. Like, none of that happens.
So what about the actresses? Because, like, I think the one thing that would make me go to the cinema is, like, because these are great actresses that we love. Dakota Johnson, you know, Tilda, you know, not Chloe, but okay. Like, what about the actresses?
I was worried because, like, the first scene is all Chloe, and I'm like, no. But it's okay.
But if you see, if you've seen the original, you know what that means.
Yeah, but
you don't have to worry.
Again, there's no recreation of any set pieces, so you don't have any sense of when somebody might be murdered because, like, it's so dissimilar from the original.
Don't tell me she's not the Drew Barrymore in Scream character, because that was, I was hoping for that.
You want me to tell you that or not tell you that?
Well, if you tell me that, if you tell me yes, she is, then that would entice me to go see it.
Oh, unfortunately, I can't tell you that.
Well, tell me about Tilda then. How is Tilda?
Tilda is amazing. Now, all the articles have suggested that she plays, obviously they gave away this twist that she plays multiple roles. Because all the pre-release publicity has talked about she plays this old man in the movie, which is true. But IMDb claims that she actually plays three roles. One of them credited to another actor, but it says that it's her. So I don't know if that's true or not, or IMDb has false info, but anyway.
So you haven't seen her as the third character?
Well, the third character comes very late in the movie, and I never once thought, oh, that's Tilda. But it's possible it was, because it's a very heavy prosthetic performance. Like, there's a ton of makeup work going on. But anyway, so I don't know. Maybe she plays three roles, maybe only two. But
yeah, because you know IMDb is always right.
Right, that's why I'm not taking it too seriously, that maybe she's not that character. But I will say the lead of the original Suspiria is in this, which I have not been following, like, the making of stuff a lot. So I didn't actually know that going into the movie, and there she was.
Oh, and you recognized her because it's been 40-something years.
Yeah, she looks exactly like, you know, that. She looks like the same person, only older. So.
And what about Dakota Johnson? She plays the lead, basically, the girl who comes to the new dancer.
Yeah, so she's basically has the Jessica Harper role, and Jessica Harper is the one who is in Suspiria, but she doesn't show up till toward the end of the movie because the movie's so freaking long, and it's one of these movies. This can be good or bad, depending on your mileage, but it's one of these movies that lets you know ahead of time how to track how far into the movie you are, because it says right at the beginning, told in 6 chapters and an epilogue. So that's like almost one of the first cards in the movie, the title cards. So when it said chapter 1, I was like, oh, okay, I'll just wait for these chapter marks and I'll know. With this insane running time, I'll know where I am. So I didn't actually feel the length that much. That wasn't my problem with this movie. I just didn't really understand what Luca Guadagnino was going for. Because it's kind of a horror movie, but it's so obsessed with, like, politics and mood that there's not a lot of actual horror in it. I just didn't really... I know some people really love it, and more power to them. I do not. Mm-hmm. I I was all prepared to like it more than the original, but I did not. The original
is it colorful? Because the original was so colorful.
It's not really, no. It's like the colors are very muted. But I don't want that to imply that it's not visually interesting, because it completely is. It just, for the color palette is nothing like the original. But the production design, I will say, of all the elements, the total MVP of the new Suspiria is the production design. That school is out of this world cool. Like every set is cool. But I just didn't, I did, in the end, I just didn't get what he was going for. I mean, I feel like I needed cliff notes on German history. And maybe that's my own bad, but whenever a movie gets that heady and you can't quite place why they're referencing history so much for a story that's not really about history, since it's about witches running a dance school. You know, like, I didn't see any obvious, you know, metaphoric connections between, you know, the horror elements and the Bader-Meinhof stuff. And East and West Germany. I was kind of like, okay. And then it also works in a lot of there's a lot of religious stuff too, because I don't remember the circumstances of the lead character in the original film, but in this one she's basically, it doesn't specify, but she's basically Amish. Because there's flashbacks.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there's flashbacks to her childhood, so.
Well, she was definitely not Amish in the first one.
Okay. I'm just saying there, I feel like Luca, either I was too dense to understand, or he was basically any idea he had, he put in the movie. Because it feels like a lot at all times, and I couldn't figure out how any of the things related to each other.
I mean, that's one thing I noticed in the discourse about it, is like, if you talk about it to more than two people, it's as if they're describing two completely different movies. So I think that sort of plays into your point, which is it has so many ideas. Like, you and I could go and see it, and we would see a completely different movie.
Yeah. And I imagine, like, if you're a student of German history, you'd probably get a lot out of it. I'm hoping, at least. Unless that's also an idea that's not fully explored, since there's 17 other ideas.
I mean, it just sounds to me like a movie I don't need to hurry and see. Like, I'll see it eventually, but yeah. I'm not in a hurry.
And even Tilda, like, she's very good, but it's not like one of her performances that you can't miss. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying.
It's not even really an actor's showcase type movie. Yeah. So I was a little disappointed. But despite my aversion to long movies, I did not really have trouble with the length.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the length is a deterrent, but once you're in it, the time passes.
I mean, it was interesting enough that I wasn't looking at my watch or anything. And also, as I started to say but didn't really complete the thought, the six chapters helped me, because they seemed to go by pretty quick. Like, I was like, oh, I'm already at chapter 3, I'm fine, you know?
That's actually a good thing in a long movie, to tell you so that you know what's happening, so
yeah,
you don't start feeling anxious. Has it only been 10 minutes?
I mean, I will say some of the chapters are longer than others, but I never was like, oh my god, I still have 3 chapters to go. I never had any moment like that, which I have had before in movies where it tells you up front. Like, do you remember that movie that Cillian Murphy made years ago, where he played like the sort of trans character?
You have to be a little bit more specific than that.
I know everybody's played a trans character before. People objected to that. I am looking it up. He even had...
Is it The Breakfast at Pluto?
That one? Yes. where he played Patrick Kitten Braden. Young Trans Woman. That's what it says. A Neil Jordan movie. But anyway, that movie also had a chapter thing, but I think they told you ahead of time it was like 17 chapters or something. But they're
that is a lot of chapters.
I know, but they're super, super short. So it'd be like chapter two or chapter... But I remember in that movie, this is like 12 years ago, and it's still scarring to me, because it's over 2 hours, but it's not as long as Suspiria, but it's like, I think I was on like chapter 12, and I'm like, this movie is never going to end. Because I knew I still had like 5 more chapters.
Yeah, but 17 is just a lot. You're just like, exhausted from the beginning. 17, wow.
So, anyway. Yeah, so, and there's a to make a long, long story short, there's a lot of good movies out right now, so go see them. And if you saw Suspiria this weekend, please tell us what you thought, because, like Murtado was implying, I'm sure people are going to see a different movie than I saw.
And also go see Wildlife. We haven't talked about it in the podcast because I think we've covered it enough on the site.
Yeah.
But we would love to hear what you guys thought of it, because that's also been out for a couple of weeks now.
And I think you and I, Murtada, are like the two super fans of that movie.
Yes. I think Chris also likes it, so maybe it's just a film experience.
It's a film experience darling this year, Wildlife. But other people don't seem as excited, but they're wrong, is my point. So go see.
They are very wrong if they're not excited about that one.
And that's coming. I'm not even a big Carey Mulligan person, but she's so brilliant in it.
Absolutely amazing. And they're trying really hard. Like, they are doing 2 weekends of Q&As in LA and New York. Like, people usually do 1 weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely
pushing it, which is good. Hopefully it will get some people. There is like, I'll send you the link and maybe you can put it in the podcast post. But an actor friend of Carrie's and Zoe's dressed as Carey Mulligan in her green dress from Wildlife for Halloween and went to the Q&As with her in LA last night. And it was on Instagram. It's really cute.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Go see Border, Burning, and The Hate U Give, and report back. Oh, and Wildlife, and report back.